This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome everyone to this very special edition of Monday Match Analysis. This is part two of the 2024 Roland Garros preview. But really, the conversation that is today's episode is one that could have aired last week. It's one that could air next week. What we're really doing here with Tom Corey, lead analyst at Tennis Viz, is we are deep diving into some analytics in regards to the Roland Garros contenders. So the draw is out. My draw preview is already up. But in this conversation, we're going to really get into the weeds, looking at a lot of the contenders for the RG title, how they've done this year, how they've played, and just kind of decoding a lot of storylines. Players who have overachieved, why have they overachieved? Players who have underachieved, why might that be? What can the numbers tell us? I really hope, and I know I've thrown a lot of content on the feed this week, I really hope people don't skip this one because I am so enthused at the insight and the quality of conversation that Tom was able to bring to the table. Right now, the world is watching one of the biggest tournaments in tennis. As the clay settles, the stakes rise at Roland Garros. Join Tennis Channel Plus in the heart of the action with daily live coverage of the second week at the French Open. Every point has the potential to be a historic moment in tennis history. And you never know when you're going to witness a match that will be talked about for years to come. So stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it all goes down. We're joined once again by Tom Corey, the lead analyst at Tennis Viz, for something I'm so excited for. It's going to be part two of our Roland Garros preview, but something that can really be applied to the first half of the tennis season. We're going to be looking at a lot of really, really cool data. Tom, can you tell us a little bit about, just before we get into it, some of the things we're going to be looking at as we go through player by player ahead of RG?
Sure. Thanks, Gil. Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me on. Great to talk about tennis with someone like yourself. And we're going to be looking at some of the next generation metrics that us at Tennis Viz, together with Tennis Data Innovations, have created, such things as shot quality, which I'm sure your fans are familiar with because of the social media world and going out on the ATP World feed. So things like shot quality, things like who's attacking the most, conversion, which is points won attack, steal score, and then as well as some of the more traditional data, like just more basic things like points won and serve and return and things like that. So we're going to dive into various of those things about the different players.
Yeah, I don't know when I had you on last, but we were kind of looking at the platform as a whole. You guys have gotten all famous now, I don't need to spell it out. Like, everybody is aware of Tennis Insights and shot quality and conversion. People have gotten used to it. So well done on your end, because I know that was the goal, to kind of get people familiarized with some of the things that you do. Let's jump into it. And the order of this is going to be somewhat random. Let's start with Jannik Sinner, who obviously has been, in terms of quality of play, when he's been healthy, which has been most of the year until this clay season, the best player in the world. Nobody has won more matches at a higher clip, and you can really tack on that incredible run post-US Open going back to the last calendar year as well. And what I've been saying, Tom, is I don't know what Sinner isn't good at. I look at the completeness of his game, and like I always get questions when someone goes on a run. Gil, how do you beat this guy? What do you need to do to beat Sinner? What style do you need to play? What strategy do you need to employ? And what I've been saying is that is so hard to answer because I don't see a lot of holes. So analytically, when you look at the full picture of Sinner, my question is, what is he bad at? What is he worst at? Where can he get better?
Bad at nothing. Based on the data of myself, if I screw, I'll come on to some screen sharing in a minute, but to go worst at, it's still based on the data, it's still his serve. If you're going to say like the worst part of his game, because I looked into the numbers and lots of things in preparation for this. Right now, his serve quality is ranked at 8.1, an 8.8 for this season, an 8.1 for his average. That puts him higher than tour average, but puts him 36th in the serve shot quality leaderboard, because there are a lot of good serve. Now people might go, yeah, his serve's really good, but there's a lot of good servers in the world of tennis. Some people that aren't anywhere near, with all respect to them, as good players as Sinner. Rinderknecht, for example, rocket of a serve. He gets a higher serve quality score than Sinner, but he's nowhere near as good a player. Fritz, higher serve quality score, better player than Rinderknecht, but not as good a player as Sinner. So there are lots of players with him than that. Interestingly also, if you look and you dive in a little bit deeper, his first serve effectiveness, and I'll show that more on the platform in a minute, but serve effectiveness, as a reminder to your fans, is we combine aces, unreturned serves, and serves that create attacking opportunities. His first serve effectiveness is slightly above the tour average, but his second serve effectiveness is below the tour average. So his second serve effectiveness is a few percent below the tour average, the tour. So it's still an area of his game where he can improve. But then when we dive into the other things that people have said about him in the past, well, he doesn't come forward a lot. He doesn't volley as well. He doesn't have as much shot variation. His net points won in the last 52 weeks and also this year is up at 69%. The tour average is 63%. So he's winning enough points when he comes to the net. He's filling that gap very nicely. Of course, he comes to the net smart. He's not net rushing, but he's getting more and more clinical when he comes in. And his shot variation is low. The tour average, I'm looking at my numbers over here, but the tour average is 80%. Of core shots, and we define core shots as your topspin ground strokes that cross the baseline rather than angles or drop shots or slices. And he plays with 88% core shots, and the tour plays with 80% core shots. And you'll have someone with Alcaraz will play like 70% core shots. But
core shots are kind of your regular topspin ground strokes from the baseline, right?
Exactly. And your variation shots are your slices, your drop shots, your angles, and your volleys. So he plays with less than the tour average, but it doesn't matter, because if you're that good at what he's good at, then people going, he needs to add more variation, I would go, does he? He's got quite a nice balance of variation right now. Does he need to add more variation? Might he when he gets a bit older and gradually as he gets more comfortable? Sure, but it's not a problem at the moment.
Serve stuff is fascinating. That kind of aligns with the eye test, even though sometimes when a guy improves so much in a stroke, it can kind of cloud the narrative around it. So Sinner went from the serve is way underperforming for his height to now it's not way underperforming. Now it's slightly, you know, maybe above average. So it's okay. But I think still for someone who's 6'4", lanky, still, you know, kind of building up strength in the legs, it seems like that's an area that can get better. I think he finally, I mean, he's tinkered so much with the technique. I think he's gotten to a place that he can feel really good about where he's at right now. But the second serve thing, it really interests me. I thought his second serve held him back big time in 2022. He doesn't really hit a kick serve. It's really kind of a slice to the body. So and almost every time. It's kind of his go-to second serve. It's sliced into the body. And it's interesting that the effectiveness of that doesn't show to be that high. Maybe there's some extra variance in the second serve that he can bring to his game. So if you have anything to tack on to that, or we can move on to the next player.
No, I mean, the only thing I tack on is his serve is very good. So right. It's not, so I'm not suggesting that it's not good. And if you take certain matches, then he does serve with a very high shot quality and with some of the better players in the world. It's just, if you're asking me what is the worst part of his game, if I take everything else and I put it into our leaderboards, he's near the top of everything. And then it's just that he's not. And then the only other thing I will throw out, which isn't serve, is that his steal score is 37% for the last 52 weeks. The steal score tour average is 34%. I'll come on to a bit later who the best players are, but they are higher than him. So he could defend a bit better, but he's also improved that part of his game. That's his 52 week average. If I take that more recently, then it is higher. And that is one thing that if you were really nitpicking, could he be a little bit better at? Maybe.
Love it. Well, I mean, that's what we're doing is nitpicking, because it's been hard with the naked eye, especially when someone doesn't lose matches. It's pretty hard to say this is where they need to be better, and that's where we were at with Sinner for a while. Okay, so that was great. I want to stay on the serving topic and ask you about Carlos Alcaraz.
Sure.
Because there's been a lot of talk with him. It's been uncontroversial. The answer to the question, where can he get better, everyone has been saying for 2+ years, it's clearly the serve. I don't want to kind of name drop or throw Andy Roddick under the bus, because I actually think what he said was completely harmless. But he was on his podcast a couple months ago and said Alcaraz hasn't really improved the serve. Juan Carlos Ferrero says, no, we have improved the serve. I'm curious to know what the data says about Alcaraz's serve. Is it getting better, or is it staying the same, or is it fluctuating? What's the trend on his serve?
Right. I'm going to screen share so I can show some of the numbers as well as talk to them. The trend says that depends. It depends which level of detail you look at, but actually it's more towards the Roddick camp. So I've filtered here 2024, and if I compare his serve quality number to his 52-week average, which is this yellow number over here, his serve quality for 2024 is 7.6. His serve quality for the last 52 weeks is 7.7. So that suggests that it's marginally worse. And his first serve effectiveness is 50%. The tour average is 60%. And again, his first serve effectiveness is worse than his 52-week average. So this year, his first serve, based on the numbers, is not better than it was. His second serve, on the other hand, is. So his effectiveness is up by over 3% for his second serve. So he's creating more attacking opportunities. One thing to add on that, when going back to Sinner, when we talked about his second serve as well, is that the measure of effectiveness is creating the attacking opportunities. If you win way high amount of neutral opportunities, then there's a good argument for it. It doesn't matter if you're setting up attacking opportunities, because if you're beating everyone in neutral. Anyway, and then if you dive into Alcaraz, this is getting into the weeds of some nerdy stuff, and we won't always go this deep, but I'll give you one bit here. This is the serve quality of Carlos, and the T serve, again, this yellow, so sorry for the viewers listening, but we're looking at a court graphic of his serve placement, and the T serves on both sides, his average for 2024 is below his T serves for the last 52 weeks. So there's something in the T serves on both sides, which is, you know, sometimes you might look at the sliders on both sides, like wide on the juice, T on the ad, and go, well, that's not as good as the flat serves. But for him, not as accurate, and that will be not the speed as you've mentioned. That's gone up. That's the accuracy, which you can't quite see from this graphic, but you have to dive into the specific matches and figure out where those serves are not going so close to the lines, which affects the shot quality score.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at that, and I know we're looking at a lot of serves right now, but I imagine for those watching on YouTube, you're seeing a lot of dots all around the box. If we were looking at, let's say, a Hubert Hurkacz's first serve, I think you'd see way more dots close to the sidelines, right?
Absolutely would, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you look at Novak, for example, you don't see any dots in the body because he doesn't serve body on serves. Like lots of the guys don't. Whereas Alcaraz is throwing quite a few, if I look at his placement there, you know, 24% body on the ad, 22% body on the juice. So, and is he going body there to really do damage, or is he going body there because actually some of those balls he's aiming slightly wider and he's not as accurate? To go back to your original point, the data is agreeing with Roddick.
Awesome. So that's interesting. I know that they have looked at it. I know that the effort is there to make gains on the serve. And there were comments from an Alcaraz assistant coach that they've tried to kind of adjust the rhythm of it, actually throw the ball toss higher, get that pause in the trophy position. But it seems like they kind of need to stay in the lab on this.
When you look at numbers like this, there is always the caveat of this is the average of all the matches in 2024. Has he served well in matches? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Will it have improved in a single match compared to his average? Definitely. Improvement doesn't go on I was a coach before I became an analyst. I'm extremely aware that improvement does not go on a straight line like that. You improve and you'll have one or two good matches at something, then it'll stop improving and then they'll keep doing it. So both can be right. Ferrero can be right. He's improving. Yeah. It's not yet being represented in consistency of the numbers.
Sure. I definitely think the mindset has changed. If you look at Alcaraz 2022, first half of 2023 even, I don't even think it was much of an effort for him to get free points, to hit some aces. The serve aggression has undoubtedly gone up. So I imagine, like, if we looked at average speed, it's gone up. But I think what's also apparent is that the placement, the spot serving is where he's lagging behind the really above average servers on tour.
Yeah. Agreed.
All right. Let us go now to
this episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
To Grigor Dimitrov, who's, I mean, look, he's slowed down on the clay, and sometimes the clay will do that to Grigor. But there was an amazing run there from post-Wimbledon last year up until, up through March. Obviously, there was the great run in Miami. If you take that stretch of time, Dimitrov basically never got upset. Like, nobody who isn't elite was able to beat him. And he also had some big wins over the likes of a Carlos Alcaraz. He had some really awesome standout wins. What has been, because from an age standpoint, you don't expect a guy like Grigor to start to play the best tennis of his life. I believe he's 32, but I don't have that in front of me, and sometimes I mess that up. So where have you seen Dimitrov really jump in the last year or so?
Right. Yeah, and this is where these tools, I'm using the ATP Tennis IQ, like I said, that together with Tennis Data Innovations, we bring to all the players. So all this data that I'm showing you is open to the players and the players' teams. And this is where this tool gets great, because I've put in the beginning of 2022 to Beijing 2023. So I could have done Wimbledon, like you said, but, you know, they're relatively similar, like the summer of last year. That's what I mean. And then from the middle of, after Beijing, when he really went on that tear, to now. And then if you look at, there's a couple of things that stand out. So this is that 2022 and 2023. And this is the conversion score, points won when you're in attack. Pretty high, 68%. The tour average is 66%. He's always been a good attacker because he comes forward well, Dimitrov, when he does come in. He's obviously got a very good forehand, so when he gets the chances, he does. He takes them. But then if you look at after that, he's jumped to 71%. Now, 71% as an average number is elite. So he's being very clinical when he's attacking. Also with Dimitrov, there has been like a perception, which is, I've seen it, so I agree with sometimes with the perception that he might dip in and out of his level of performance. He might be playing well and then 5-0 against some of the top players. He puts in a weaker game and therefore gets broken and loses the set. But conversion score, because it's effectively measuring how clinical you are. So when you're in attack, do you win those points, is a great signal for clutchness as well. Because right. All the top players will have high scores in this. Even if they're not brilliant defenders, they'll have really high scores in attacking and being clinical. And that's one area that he's improved for sure. And then another one, which we've talked about already, but is the first serve effectiveness. So if I go back to where I was, 64% first serve effectiveness, jumps up to 67 in the good period. So does his first serve in percentage. So his in percentage goes up by 2 or 3% in that comparison. It's 3% in that comparison. So you're making more first serves and you're being more effective with it and creating those attacking chances. And then you go on and be really clinical when you are attacking, means you hold serve all the time. And then that puts more pressure on your opponent. And then I hadn't really considered this, but then his steal score's gone up by 3% in that period as well. So then you're holding serve and then steal, which I'll come onto in a bit, gives you a good chance to break serve as well. So
yeah, this kind of confirms a lot of the eye test stuff that I've observed, because my answer to the question without access to the hard data has been the serve forehand. They both look so big, so in charge. And I don't know that always used to be the case. He's always been brilliantly athletic, tons of variety, a beautiful player to watch. But I've never thought of him as someone who's just going to really smother you with first serve forehand. And that's the main thing that I've seen. And I do feel like the numbers are kind of fleshing that out in the serve effectiveness going higher and the conversion score going higher, because Dimitrov, 80% of the time is, and I don't, that's not an exact number, but he's attacking with his forehand more often than not his backhand. So when you have first serves and forehands, I feel like that's where you're getting that attack number or that conversion number nice and high.
Exactly, yeah. And then I just looked at it. It's average for, Dimitrov is a sneaky, excellent server, not just a good, but an excellent server. His average first serve speed is 125 miles an hour. The tour average is 117. He's got a rocket. Now, because of what you described earlier, because he moves so well, he's got the one-handed backhand, he's a character. People don't think of him as a big server, but he is a big server. He's just got other skills as well. So he puts it all together, and then he does what he did to Alcaraz in Miami, where he just like, well, he's one of the best players in the world.
Yeah, unbelievable. There have been dark years for Dimitrov. Like if you look at some of the dips, it's actually, you know, he's had right shoulder issues. So there have been like periods in time where that serve has I think gone down just because of the health. But luckily that stuff has subsided and now he's back to the bomb. 125. That's awesome.
He's got a rocket.
Yeah. So Stefanos Tsitsipas fell outside of the top 10. Didn't have a great clay court season last year. So when you were looking at the 52 weeks after Miami, it didn't paint the picture that Tsitsipas has been painting for the several years of his career before this, which is I'm a basically consistently a top six player, more or less. Hits the clay, wins Monte Carlo in what was the best title run we've seen throughout the clay court swing, because the draw was very, very difficult and he racked up quality wins. And we've seen this before with Tsitsipas. He's never played well at Indian Wells or Miami. Monte Carlo, he's now won three times. So he hits the clay, he gets better. We have theories as to why, those of us who have watched carefully. What do the numbers say, hard court to clay, why Tsitsipas gets so much better?
Yeah. That's a good question. And one of them, which may surprise people, is something I touched on earlier, but is look at the jump. So sorry, here, this screen, we're looking at clay this year, 2024 clay. This screen, we're, sorry for the listeners, I'm clicking between screens. Steel score is the answer. His movement, well, one of the answers, his movement and his defense, he's up to winning 38% of points in defense on the clay so far this year. Tour average again is 34. I know that's 4%, but that's a lot of points that you're turning round. And his on the hard courts, he's 33%. So he's coming into the clay and people talk about how well he moves on the clay, and he does. And then that's leading to him winning more points. And one of the things, Tsitsipas is obviously on any surface, again, got a very good serve like Dimitrov. So he's going to hold serve, but his returning is not as good as some of the other players, shot quality and all metrics, it's not as good. So if you don't return as well, then on other people's serves, you end up defending more because you don't put any, the best returners, Novak, etc., will put people under pressure with your return. If you're blocking returns or just not returning as well, you end up defending more. So if you're defending more on people's service games, the only way to break is to defend well, which he's done. And then if you look into, to back up what I'm saying about the steel score, break points won on the clay, 41%. Break points won on the other surfaces, still high actually, at 39%, but total return games won 24% on the hard courts, and then up to 30% on the clay courts. So, and that's not a part of Steph's game, because obviously he's known for his serve and his forehand, because his serve and his forehand are two of the better shots in tennis. His inside-out forehand, his ability to control the middle of the court with his forehand is excellent. So that is better on the clay than it was on the hard because he's making more balls and he's more accurate with it. Which I think you, I think we sent you some of that data you talked about in one of your other podcasts after Monte Carlo. So that is better. But the biggest thing, which is perhaps not what everyone thinks of, was his ability to turn points around in defense.
Yeah, and I mean, if we can, so that's great stuff. If we can visualize it and try to make sense of it from a technical standpoint, this is how I would try to explain it to people. If someone hits a great forehand inside out into Tsitsipas's backhand, we know he doesn't have the best defensive slice. On the clay, how much more likely is it that he gets to the spot in time because the ball slows down more on the bounce and he's able to hit a drive backhand from the deep in the court out of the corner and maybe get back in the point, where on the hard court, the ball skids low and fast, no time to drive it, has to slice it, slice pops up, someone, you know, knocks away a volley or finishes the next forehand. The extra time that the clay provides allows Tsitsipas to defend, I think, so much better on his backhand. And then I think his forehand defense also might improve on the clay, but I think it's awesome across surfaces. I love the way he plays out of his forehand corner. So that's kind of my read on it, and kind of decoding the numbers and trying to explain why they are how they are.
But also, yeah, and to add to your point, is even on the clay, if he's moving and he doesn't hit as good defensive slice as some of the other players, he's able to, on the clay, get to a few more of those, maybe float it still. We'd have to look at the video and some of the other metrics to prove whether he's zipping it a bit more. But even if he's floating it, it's harder for the players to then put the ball away on the clay. So making that extra shot, even if it's less effective,
yep,
it's more beneficial on the clay than it is on a fast, like Miami hard court, for example.
Sure, because he is such a good mover. Similar storyline was Casper Ruud at one point. People were down on him after a kind of start to finish a rough 2023. You had the Roland Garros final in there, and then he didn't build on that. He kind of went back to the pre-RG form where things weren't going the way he wanted. This year has been awesome. I mean, his win-loss record, his win percentage is up around 80%. He's made finals on hard court. He had a good clay court season. Have you seen anything in his tactics or the way he's playing, perhaps more aggressive, that has allowed Ruud to kind of get back to winning at a top eight, borderline top five rate?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that you had mentioned before, that what was his backhand line, which I know is, again, and this is some of the cool stuff with the data, right? Is you don't think, you don't necessarily think Tsitsipas, and as a general fan, think defense like you do with Carlos or you do with Medvedev or Dimonau, where it's sort of obvious. But the data is saying that that's a difference maker. Same thing with Ruud. You don't think backhand when you think of him because his forehand is one of the best in the world, and particularly on the clay. But his backhand, this graphic was showing how he, changing direction more effectively on the clay, which obviously if you are playing and you change direction on your backhand side, you're getting the person to move out to the forehand side, which one, you might put them under pressure, but even if you don't put them under pressure, they more often go cross court and you're back into a forehand exchange, which is where he wants to be. Whereas if he's hitting his backhand, trying to hit it cross, leaving it in the middle of the court, then the opponents are then hitting forehands and either going back to his backhand or making him completely on the run to the forehand. So that shot is crucial for good forehand players, the backhand line, because it gets you out of that exchange. And if you can get out of that exchange with increased accuracy, like we're showing here in this graphic, and more speed, then you even put them on the run, then they give you a middle forehand and he crunches it and he's one of the best at that. So that was one of the things.
I love this. For those listening, we have on the Tennis Insights Instagram account, which everybody should follow, it's showing that on Ruud's backhand down the lines, comparing clay 2024 and hard 2024. On clay, he's hitting it more often in terms of the percentage frequency. The in percentage is a massive leap, 82.6% up to 88.4%. The speed is 4 miles per hour faster. The spin is less, which is actually a good thing. When you're going down the line, you don't necessarily want to hit a ball with a lot of loop and shape. You want that to be more like a laser than a grenade. And then accuracy within 1 meter of the sideline is also up quite a bit, about 3%. So the backhand down the line more often and better.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for bringing that to life.
Oh, of course.
You can tell who's the professional in this setup.
Okay, Holger Rune. This is someone who didn't have the clay court season that he would have wanted. Going into last year's French Open, Tom, he was fourth in my power rankings, super high. This year, he's not in the top 10 of my power rankings. You know, it was so awesome last year. This year, he hasn't been able to put it together. And I'm just wondering, because we know he has all the talent in the world, all the skill in the world, is there something, is he playing the right brand of tennis? Because I think about the run that he had, like how he beat Djokovic in Rome. He was not aggressive, not at all. He was ultra patient. He just ground him down. He outlasted him. He kept the ball deep. He was consistent. His defense was awesome. And Djokovic didn't really have the shot tolerance to match. I don't see Rune playing that way anymore. I see a very attacking, aggressive, take the ball early, come forward a lot, hit the forehand big and fast. Is that the right way that, like, is that how he should be playing?
Yep. It's a good question. I will go on the record here, and this is not a data thing, this is a Tom Corrie thing, and go, I believe Rune is a, which is not that out there, but I think he's a future world number one. Mm-hmm. So when people will might get on him at the moment, like he has obviously dropped off, he's dropping down ranking points, etc. But he's got everything, like Carlos, like Sinner, different, but his serve is a rocket. He moves incredibly well. His forehand and backhand are both big. He can go cross court and line on both. He comes forward very well. So it's a matter of time, in my opinion, rather than whether he can do it. His in attack score, as you pointed out on one of your other podcasts where we gave you the data, at different points in different tournaments is up there with some of the most aggressive players like Eubanks or a Cressy, which is surprising. So in those, but obviously if you are more aggressive, there is more chance you miss. And the numbers don't lie on that. The bottom line is, despite the belief I have, like I've just said about how he can be there, at the moment, in the last 52 weeks or this year, for his forehand in percentage, so just the calculation of how many forehands he makes, he's 83%. The tour average is 84%. All the top 10 guys are higher. Most of them are way higher than the tour average. His backhand in percent is 84%. The tour average is 85%. So he's less consistent than the tour. So there's a point where if you are that aggressive, more balls have got to go in the court if you're going to be winning all the time.
And let's be clear, you know, the viewpoint I come from, that's, I love in percentage as a stat. It's like my favorite. If we were looking at Jan Lennard Struff and his in percentage was lower, it would be, okay, well, you don't move that well. You don't defend that well. So you need to attack. Like, that's how you should play. For Rune, I think his defense is outstanding. I think his movement is outstanding. And that's where I'm lean towards, let's get a little more consistent so we can rely on those things a little bit more. Now the attack is great. And why the reason we think Holger is going to be such a good player is he can do both. He can do everything at such a high level. But I've questioned the ultra aggressive play because I'm looking at a guy who moves and defends well.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's like he is part of this new generation of players where he's good at everything, like Sinner. And there was an argument with Sinner more than 18 months ago, probably 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where he first sort of came into the public eye. Obviously, the coaches had known he's going to be really good since the age of 12. But since he came into the public eye, where you were watching him sometimes, and I was watching him going like, he is unloading on everything. Like, this seems a bit carnage back then. And then with his team and his maturity, he's now found the balance where he's still unloading on most things. But there's times where he makes more balls, like a Novak, and then unloads at the right times. And I agree. I think Holger will find that balance a bit more, and then he'll win more.
Yeah. Okay, we have three more players I definitely want to get to, about 9 minutes to do it, is Nadal. I feel like he's still striking the ball well. Now, I think the serve is clearly not at a level that you would want it to be to win matches on tour. I think the movement has gotten to a point where it's below average, and, you know, he's not defending like he used to. The physicality as a whole, you know, recovering between matches, lasting during long matches, I think all that stuff has gone down. But I feel like the ball striking has been good. I'm wondering, is there anything that Nadal is still doing at an elite level at his age?
Yeah, and we just posted this recently where we looked into some of the numbers. And I mean, I think there's lots of things. Elite. It's a tough one, isn't it? Because, yeah, everything he's still doing is still at elite level. Is it?
Do you want me to define this? This is like, I throw the word elite around all the time. That means like 3 to 8 players, or we'll say 3 to 10 players. That's like elite range.
Yeah, exactly. And he's obviously, one of the things we looked into is his forehand, because he's been probably more open than in the past in some of his press conferences about how his body's feeling, because he's not hiding it anymore, obviously, and where he's going with it. And he said before Rome, like, now's the time to up it, test my body going into Roland Garros. And we heard that and we went, right, let's look into it. And the graphic I'm showing here is Barcelona to Madrid to Rome. And you can see from the graphic, the forehand, which has obviously been one of his most, everything's destructive with him, but, you know, one of the best shots on a clay court ever. And good signs for the Nadal fans. Speed went up. Top spin was back to his ludicrous level. So we're up at 3,448 RPMs. So up considerably from where he was. And then shot width, by one of our definitions, so keeping the ball out the middle of the court, also increased. The in percentage dropped in Rome. So this is the whole thing about tennis, right? Quality, that people can hit great quality, but it's got to go in as well. So if he puts those two things together in Roland Garros, before, to back up one sec, is Barcelona and Madrid, like, the forehand was nowhere near as dangerous as it was in the past. So less speed, less quality. It was going in, but if it goes in and it's that Rafa forehand that isn't really jumping and maybe landing on the service line, then other players aren't so fearful of it anymore. So that's the good news, is the forehand was getting better. The bad news is that when we look at some of the defensive data, and this graphic I've put on the screen has a lot of numbers on it, but the short story is his ability to turn points around in defense, his steal score is way lower than it used to be. His ability to just make balls in defense is lower than it used to be. We with our technology can define this graphic on the right is how well someone counterattacks and turns around in one shot. And on this next graphic, he in Rome 2019 was nearly 24% of the time when he was in defense would hit a winner or put the other person back into defense themselves. So that counterattack ability. So, I mean, that's huge. He's obviously one of the best at that ever. And that was down at 13%. So getting close to half that. And obviously that's not a surprise to everybody. He's not moving as well, but the numbers are backing it up.
Yeah, exactly. No surprise there. All right. He's playing Alexander Zverev in the first round. Blockbuster first round, to say the least. Zverev coming off the Rome title. We know his serve is just off the charts good. We know his two-hander is basically off the charts good, one of the best in the world. To me, his forehand is the barometer for how well he's going to play, for how dangerous he's going to be. And I thought in Rome it looked really good.
Yeah, his forehand in Rome was excellent. It was excellent. And he said it in one of his post-match interviews. He said, the forehand is the shot that either loses me matches or wins me matches. Or he said, win tournament or lose tournament. So I don't remember exactly. But that is the truth of the matter. And one of the things I will say about Zverev is his forehand is not as bad as people make out it is. Now that we have like mass data.
It does go in, right? It does go in.
Well, it goes in, but the key thing is, I'll clarify what I mean by that, is now that we have mass data across the tour, all 250s qualifying up through to thousands, we're collecting every shot, right? So we're collecting every time Zverev plays. Now, what we do as pundits and fans, which I'm obviously guilty of at times as well when I'm being a fan, is you remember the time he played Alcaraz in the semi-final of so-and-so, or Djokovic indoors in Turin, where you play, or the O2 in the past in London, and Djokovic is taking the ball so early, rushing him so much on his forehand, he's a bit tight or a bit whatever, and then he has those bad forehand days, which definitely happen, and then as fans, everyone goes, oh, his forehand's rubbish, and then you watch him play a 250 in the second round where no one is watching, or less people are watching him play, and he's toasting his forehand around. Yep. And what he did in Rome was that all week. He's hitting it fast. We've done loads of numbers and I've got all the numbers to back it up and they're all on our social media, but he's hitting it hard. He's hitting it accurate and he's hitting it in. So it's a very good shot when he's in those moments. And across the year, it's still way better than people think it is, because they've got in our head what we all do, that bias of the one bad match that we remember, or there's more than one, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised by that at all. It's always the nerves factor with Zverev, and people used to make a big thing about his second serve. Second serve, to me, it's not the problem anymore. It's the forehand, which you have to hit loads of them in big moments. It's just, there's no avoiding it. The second serve he often does avoid because he makes 75% of his first serves. And it's, you know, the predictability cross court, the speeds go down a little bit. Those are some of the forehand issues that Zverev has had. If he can keep hitting it hard, keep going down the line in big moments, he's going to be really tough to beat at the French. Tom, last player I want to talk about is one Novak Djokovic, still a Roland Garros contender. In the fullest sense, it doesn't matter what he looks like in the lead up, playing Talon Griegspoor right now as we're recording this in Geneva. But the question is, you know, where has he declined the most this year analytically? Because obviously no title runs, some uncharacteristic losses, some uncharacteristic performances. Where has he declined the most?
And with the beauty of Tennis IQ, as I'm not screen sharing it, but I've just clicked on the numbers, 7-5-3 love up, conversion score 70%, steal score 39%. Some of his shot quality is not as high, but looking by the numbers, like Novak does. Where's he declined? He's declined across various things in the bad matches. I think the biggest thing is that he hasn't been what he often is, which is just that level of consistency across the whole year. So he's put in some really high performances on the numbers versus Safulin in Monte Carlo, versus Dimonar in Monte Carlo. He had some dips, but he still had decent numbers. And then he's had some bad performances, which bring everything down. So it's more the consistency in general from him. Look, if he finds his groove here in Geneva, which it looks like he's doing, it's tough to bet against him over five sets because who he is. Yeah. So that was the first answer I've answered with not a lot of numbers, but I think it's probably valid for him.
Sure. I mean, yeah, even if you look at Rome, I mean, everything looked pretty normal against Mute. You throw in the bad performance against Tabilo. So it's just the evenness that he hasn't achieved this year. Australian Open, he was in the semifinal, right? Like, you'd think from the discourse that he wasn't in the semifinal. It's just he didn't look like himself in that semifinal. And losing to Sinner is fine, but he didn't look like himself even losing. All right, Tom, this has been incredible. I know how much work went into this. And I know how busy you are, so I really, really appreciate you coming on and sharing all of this knowledge and insight with my audience.
Pleasure to be here. Look forward to the next one.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.